But if you're starting with a quality product or service, and everything in your kind of core marketing stack ties back to authenticity in kind of deep understanding and belief in why you as a company or product or service exist, and how to tell that story consistently in a digestible way that is authentic, it tends to resonate with the market. And if you do that well, then the incremental gains you can get from all of the quantitative marketing tactics and strategies are icing on the cake.
Hi, my name is Sarah Panous. I've spent the last 2 decades driving digital content for billion-dollar brands. Now I help content marketers build winning brand storytelling strategies and reduce feelings of overwhelm and confusion. Join me as we discuss strategy, creativity, confidence, and building a better connection with your audience. Think of this as a creative content marketing jam session mixed with chicken soup for the soul. This is the Marketing with Empathy podcast. Hey, Kindred Speakers. What's it take to crack through and get noticed? That's something every company wants to do, right? Well, today we're going to get a behind-the-scenes look at how Dollar Shave Club built a uniquely human connection in their marketing that cracked open one of the most consolidated markets in the world with razors, and how today's guest uses storytelling and is reinventing direct mail marketing to win the modern marketing game and stand out in a world obsessed with shiny widgets and short-sighted marketing tactics. My guest expert, Dave Fink, believes the best kept secret in marketing is hiding where you least expect it, your mailbox. Over a 20-year career, he's generated hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenue, powered viral sensations like Dollar Shave Club, and helped launch celebrity startups for Jessica Simpson, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, and Kate Bosworth. Now, as founder and CEO of Posty, he's out to reinvent direct mail marketing for a digital world. My full conversation with Dave Fink after a word from our sponsors.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to speaking with you since this got scheduled.
Likewise. Okay, well, we'll start back in your Dollar Shave Club days. So I know in 2011, a man walked into Science Inc., which was the startup studio where you had recently become principal at the time. And he was there to pitch a curious idea, right? A subscription razor service. And 5 years later, Dollar Shave Club sold to Unilever for $1 billion. Dollar Shave Club majorly disrupted the razor industry. So I would love to hear about your experiences with that. And so my first question is, you know, what was it like during those first 5 years with the brand?
Well, how many hours do we have here? It was an absolute masterclass in disruption, creativity, execution. I mean, if there was going to be a movie on, you know, building a D2C brand and taking on a behemoth, you know, the Dave and Goliath story, that would be it. And that doesn't happen very often, right? Like typically, you know, you hear these crazy stories and it seems like it was all easy and everything kind of went smoothly. And very rarely is that the case, but just those facts that you shared, which is, you know, Mike Dubin, who's, you know, just a brilliant creative marketing mind who developed into a really capable entrepreneur, had a palette of razors, a really, really crummy, rough sketch of a website, and a rough cut of a really funny viral video. That was like his entire, you know, asset package. And like you said, less than 5 years later, there was a $1 billion exit to one of the largest, you know, CPG conglomerates in the world, right? Think about how fast, you know, 4.5, 5 years goes. And I can tell you what, it doesn't mean that it was perfect and everything, you know, went as planned, but it really was In many cases, the fairy tale, any entrepreneur closes his or her mind and thinks about what it's like to build a startup, maybe from a naive perspective, like it was about as close to that as possible. Mm-hmm. And I can share some specifics if you'd like. Example one is, it's 2011, and I think everyone listening to this program, takes for granted, the platforms that are, the big social media giants, right? We know what Facebook is, we know what Instagram is, now TikTok, we know what YouTube is. But back in 2011, what is that, 11 years ago, mm-hmm. that wasn't the case. I mean, right. YouTube existed and there was a lot of content, and Facebook was kind of just becoming Facebook, the power that we know. But brands weren't, accelerating storytelling, generating global awareness on those platforms at that point. Dollar Shave Club, really, it was that meteoric overnight sensation launch that was very well crafted and planned. It wasn't a dumb luck type of thing. Mike put a lot of hard work into the scripting, the storytelling, the kind of that first person viral video genre that now has been replicated so many times with so many brands. That really was his creation. And then he had a launch strategy. So it wasn't like you could just create a funny video and all of a sudden become discovered. I mean, he was very thoughtful, and his team was very thoughtful in how they were going to kind of seed that video into the world. But what nobody expected was within 24 hours, that video, I don't even remember the exact numbers anymore, but the number of video views and how that translated into this movement of, overcharging us, they're taking advantage of us. Like, let's stick it to, let's stick it to them. And with the first 24 hours, the Dollar Shave Club website was taken offline because it couldn't handle the traffic. It was rebuilt, the back-end infrastructure, literally overnight. Wow. All of us at Science, as well as the small, at that point, skeleton Dollar Shave Club team, were literally handling all the fulfillment and distribution of razors. There were, Zebra, thermal printers printing labels around the clock, where the labels were just running up and down the aisles of the startup studio. I mean, it really was craziness, right? Mm-hmm. That was the launch story of Dollar Shave Club. It's not made up. It really was the storybook sensation.
That's amazing, right? It's like the dream outcome of what you'd want when you have a startup. But they obviously tapped into a shared human thought that a lot of people really resonated with and were like, yeah, I resonate with the fact that I'm paying too much for my razors and this sounds like a great idea. So from a marketing side, then what did your tell us more about what your marketing team did to build such a strong connection with the Dollar Shave Club's audience? Was it really all focused around that video, or what other things happened as part of that?
Well, certainly, first of all, I want to, make sure the Dollar Shave Club team gets all the credit. There was an amazing CMO that joined the team very early on, named Adam Weber, came out of Procter & Gamble, and he's brilliant, marketer, leader, close friend. He's actually an investor in Posty, the company that I'm CEO of. And the Dollar Shave Club team definitely was kind of the owners of their own destiny. I was, as you mentioned, one of the founding partners at Science, and we did have a big infrastructure and marketing studio that rallied around Dollar Shave Club and about 75 other brands and helped out with everything from strategy to growth marketing and customer acquisition and retention and tooling and all that. To kind of set this story straight, we were involved in that business all the way through the end, but the Dollar Shave Club business was run out of our offices, I would say, for the first 2 years, 2.5 years. And in that case, we had kind of a hands-on front row approach the first couple of years. My experience with Dollar Shave Club and the biggest lesson that I took away is something I think that you hold very close, that prior to Dollar Shave Club, I don't know that I believed in as much or understood. Prior to Dollar Shave Club, I was definitely one of those more programmatic marketing, quantitative marketing minds that thought very much in the tactics and behavioral, you know, economic, you know, executional strategies, you know, things, you know, ranging from copywriting tactics and how to get dopamine firing in people's brains and button colors and font sizes and, you know, storytelling through a scroll versus clicks, you know, all those things that I thought for many years were kind of the end all be all. Like it was a series of tactics that led to a strong P&L. Dollar Shave Club taught me, you know, very convincingly, very quickly, that the tactics are fine. But I think that the reason that Dollar Shave Club, you know, was as successful as it was because they knew what their mission was from the start. They invested in, you know, in a blend of storytelling through entertainment that, you know, resonated with the pain point and the perceived pain point that consumers had that they were trying to solve. And then you layer on, you know, marketing channels and customer acquisition and CRM engagement and all, you know, and all of a sudden you have, you know, a really loyal customer base and a meaningful business. You know, it wasn't very, you know, far after the launch that Mike Dubin was being invited, you know, to every major college around the country to give seminars on how to create a viral video and how, you know, launch strategies and, you know, brand marketing in the age of social media. You know, remember, like they were definitively the first, you know, brand to become, you know, a national and international sensation because of storytelling and social media. You know, now the expectation is that if you're launching a brand, a product, a service, if you're a traditional incumbent brand and you're launching something new, you have a social media marketing strategy. But in 2010, 2011, that wasn't the case. They were the first to kind of teach the world that the power of, you know, social distribution and, you know, engaging your customers through these social platforms. Now it's harder as well because everybody's trying to, you know, compete. Hence why we decided to do something, I think, counterintuitive, kind of stepping towards a non-digital channel to provide value to the marketing, you know, ecosystem. But back then, I mean, look, nobody had any idea the impact that that launch strategy would have on that business.
Yeah, I remember when it came out. I remember seeing it and being aware, obviously, of Dollar Shave Club. And for me, because at that time I would have been running social and influencer content for Sleep Number in-house. And observing that was really interesting because I remember thinking it was like the first time I had seen a brand be really like face to camera and kind of cheeky and really on point about like the issue, but like the tone was very different than, you know, what you were used to seeing. So to your point of it really started this new kind of, I feel like, comfort level for businesses to be like extra, extra relatable. It's an oversimplification, but like instead of being so corporate buttoned up, like it was just like the voice, true voice of the customer, I felt like was coming through, which is why I think in the storytelling, it resonated so well. It hit the point. I talk about like an empathy filter, like what's the reason that story is going to connect? And obviously they had a very smart idea and it worked. So that is amazing.
Yeah, there was a certain playful irreverence, you know, to the tone. And look, I mean, Mike delivered, for those that aren't aware, you know, Mike Dubin, the founder and CEO of Dollar Shave Club, is the, you know, quote, actor that carried that initial video. He's charming, you know, he's likable, he's relatable, that comes through. He's just a hysterical guy. So the person you see on that video actually is very much, yeah, the actual, you know, Mike Dubin. And I think humor goes a long way. There's probably a ton of risk in that video, but you know, it was a brand new startup. You know, I think at that point, the worst case was that, okay, like didn't do anything, but it certainly, you know, there's no risk if you're trying to sell your first razor, you know, through the internet. As it turned out, it was a good risk, paid off. So if you're a brand that has a very different, you know, tone behind it, and all of a sudden you see Dollar Shave Club success, don't chase that, right? So, you know, and we saw that all the time. You know, entrepreneurs, even more established brands would show up, you know, in our office and say, oh my, you know, my goodness, like I need a viral video just as good as Dollar Shave Club. Can you make a viral video for us? Mm-hmm. One, Mike Dubin was the one who actually wrote, directed, scripted that that video. So it wasn't like there was a formula that we had at Science. It was, you know, lightning in a bottle by just a really creative mind. But the lesson is, like, you know, you can't create that same type of irreverent comedic tone if that's not authentic to your brand. You might have a more scientific approach or a more serious approach. Your audience may be different. It might be a different product category, that there already is a leader in the space that takes a humorous perspective. Whereas, you know, there was one dominant beast in the men's grooming category, that was Gillette. And it was always, you know, as the video referenced, you know, paying athletes like Roger Federer, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to be really serious about the promotion of the brand. And so it stood out differently. So I think to marketers in general, you want to be a study of consumer sentiment. You need to be, you know, aware of kind of where we are as various cultures and civilizations, and understand your audience, you know, very well, and then make marketing decisions, storytelling decisions, brand decisions on, you know, what's appropriate for your brand, versus saying, hey, let's just go replicate what Dollar Shave Club did because Dollar Shave Club was so successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great example of a company that definitely disrupted an industry and leaned into storytelling and really understood their audience and was their own voice and tone, and it worked. So I would love to switch gears then to now what you do now in current day. You're the CEO of Posty, and tell us a little bit more about what Posty is first and like who you help.
Sure. So, yeah. Posty is another one of those businesses that was created, I think, authentically out of a pain point that we as marketers had. So in the past, you know, call it 10 years, you know, we went from this time and space where a company like Dollar Shave Club could go from zero to, I think, like 4 million, you know, customers, you know, really what felt like overnight, because the rise of social media platforms like YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, to a world where every marketer, you know, has you know, worked really hard to develop expertise on those platforms, and those platforms being marketplaces became really, really oversaturated, very expensive, and very hard to find any blue sky. And so for us, you know, that the pain really started hitting probably about 2016, and we were looking around, and it's just like, I mean, it got to be the point where, especially in like holiday season, like we were having to make decisions. Like, do we just shut down all of our Facebook, you know, marketing budget because it's so expensive and not profitable? Are we willing to accept unprofitable customers for growth's sake? And we're like, wow, those are two really terrible decisions. Either one of them is a pain point. And so we started looking and exploring other digital initially channels. Like, what else is big and unsaturated, untapped, that that could help us tell our story and reach our addressable markets? And there really wasn't anything. You know, TikTok wasn't a thing at that point. Snap didn't have an ads platform. To be quite honest, back at that point, Instagram wasn't even really as powerful of a platform as it is now from a marketing perspective. And so that pushed us to spend more time offline. And because, you know, the whole world has moved to this quantitative approach to marketing, right? Like, how do you leverage, you know, data and prediction and measurement and optimization to, you know, ensure that you're getting the maximum value from each dollar that you're spending in the distribution world? And in the offline world, the one channel that started to kind of line up with how we think about, you know, really digital programmatic media channels was direct mail. And we got really excited about it. We loved the scale, right? It's 20% bigger than even Facebook or Google. Anybody with a physical address is reachable. there's, you know, abilities to use your first party and third party data in very similar ways to build lookalike audiences, to do programmatic campaigns, to run, very targeted and optimized CRM initiatives. And then there's measurement, especially for brands that have, you know, have a way to capture consumer, you know, transaction data. And so we got really excited about it. And as marketers, we set out to start testing some campaigns, and we learned really quickly that the way that you execute direct mail has not changed in 30 years. It's slow, it's clunky, it's, you know, accident prone, it's analog. And that just didn't, it just didn't line up with the sophistication and dynamic expectation that we have with our marketing initiatives these days. And so what Postie's mission is from and was from the start was, can we build a technology layer that looks and acts and gives us the tools that our favorite digital channels have, whether those are programmatic platforms like Trade Desk or social platforms like Facebook or search platforms like Google. And the hypothesis was that if we could, you know, solve the executional challenges that the channel has, all of a sudden this channel could be even more powerful than it currently is. So that's what Postie is. To summarize, it's a technology channel management solution that behaves like a digital platform, making direct mail as accessible and dynamic as your favorite digital channels.
Awesome. And I know you've made the statement that you believe direct mail is the best kept secret in marketing. Tell us more about that. I'm assuming because obviously a lot of people have been all, you know, everything went to digital. And so not as many people maybe are doing direct mail. But tell me more about direct mail and why you think it is the best kept secret in marketing.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's a little bit tongue in cheek because it is a $50 billion media channel here in the US. It's a behemoth. A lot of those dollars are flowing from big traditional incumbent categories like finance and insurance and automotive. Traditional big box retail as well has leaned into DM. What's happened is there's been two, I think, buckets of marketers. There's been the traditional marketer who has historically built out the DM channel that has been motivated to migrate those budgets to these new emerging digital channels. And then you have the other kind of more modern, newer marketer who became a marketer during an age of digital and never had a need to think beyond digital. And so those two groups of individuals are now in a position where, or not even just individuals, but teams, right, are now in a position where, like we were back in 2016, are over-dependent on really two behemoths that have become harder and harder to find profitable paths to growth. And that's a challenge. I mean, that's a real problem when you think about something. I think in the venture world, they talk about 40 cents of every venture dollar raised indirectly goes into Facebook's pockets because it's marketing budgets and those companies are grow at all costs. And I've heard that 85 cents on every dollar in digital media, which is a behemoth now, goes into Facebook and Google's pockets.
It's huge.
So when you think about 80%. Those two data points, you know, like, yeah, it's not surprising that if you're all in on those two channels, it probably means you're not running a profitable growth strategy. It's just not possible if you're competing with every one of those, you know, billions and billions of ad dollars for the same impressions. Your cost goes up, performance goes down, and you have to think about an omni-channel approach. And so for us, I think it's no different than Dollar Shave Club, you know, launching at a time before social was really proven to be this powerful channel and saying like, hey, I think there's a way to cut into market share of, you know, a behemoth that owns 80% of its category by, you know, leveraging these new emerging, you know, channels. Now it's just counterculture, right? It's saying it's the same thing. It's saying, hey, you know, everybody, you know, every brand is all in on Facebook and Google. If we want to be smart and find more efficient growth, we have to think outside the box. We have to find other channels that are not as set, you know, are not overly saturated, you know, as those two.
Definitely. Okay. And so from your experience then, how do you think companies can leverage storytelling fundamentals to stand out in this world that is obsessed with shiny widgets and short-sighted marketing tactics?
Yeah, again, I'm a broken record here, but I do, you know, preach the concept of being authentic, committed to your authentic, you know, self as a company. That certainly stems with leadership, you know, being really communicative internally, you know, certainly through the marketing team, to the product marketing team, but really every employee, contractor, service provider involved in a business should you know, have a very clear fundamental understanding of the mission, the brand position, the value propositions, the benefit statements, et cetera. And then from there, you know, it's about understanding your customer. And so, you know, I think marketers today use the term addressability, meaning, you know, we're now in a world where we're closer or directly communicating with, you know, the lion's share of consumers that engage with our brand, which means that, you know, we have the opportunity to really lean in and learn, you know, more about these different consumer segments, individuals, why they're engaging with our brand, why they believe we're solving, you know, a problem or adding value into their lives. And that insight can help ensure that not only do we understand what our brand position and our messaging and our missions are, but it can ensure that we're presenting that properly and that messaging's landing. And then once you kind of get that those core fundamental infrastructure built in your insights and storytelling and mission, then it becomes how do you translate that into messaging and storytelling across each channel in a way that's appropriate for that channel, but doesn't deviate from kind of your core authentic self. So it's not about as much about like, what's the tactic that I use to drive the highest click-through rate on a YouTube, you know, pre-roll or interstitial, or get the highest engagement rate on a direct mail piece, or get the highest open rate on an email. I think that good things come to brands and marketers that invest more in what's the appropriate way to reinforce the message that we've worked so hard to identify that represents our brand on each of these channels. And if we do that consistently and repetitively and leverage data and targeting appropriately, you put that all together and you have a really good shot at building something lasting and meaningful and performant.
Definitely. 100% agree. I'm curious, can you think of any of like your clients either now or in the past that you feel have done that really well? Like just to share an example of how that came to life for another brand?
Sure. I mean, I can take it. There are two direct mail concepts or two concepts in our world that come to mind on the
awesome.
Fly.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are thousands of them, but you know, one is there was a, this is kind of a fast growth category disruptor that was in the pet space, focused on dogs in particular. And they designed creative that not only told their story from the right lifestyle imagery and content, but they also designed the piece of mail as an origami kind of step-by-step instruction manual for how you fold their, in this case, oversized postcard into a pooper scooper.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
clever. Super clever.
Yeah, it was like super, super on point, funny. It didn't interfere with the overall value proposition they were communicating on through the creative, but it added value. It put a smirk on every recipient's, every, you know, target audience member's face, and it was memorable. Another athleisure wear brand that you know was competing in a really saturated market, right? The kind of the women's athleisure, you know, yoga space. Designed a piece that unfolds and then is a step-by-step guide to a few key yoga poses. And of course, you know, each of the images in the yoga poses were featuring, you know, model wearing their apparel. I think when you entertain and you're authentic to your brand and you're engaging, you get an extra few minutes with a consumer. And time is everything right now, right? An Instagram feed ad like goes by in a split second. Like nobody remembers them. Like the only people that remember Instagram ad are those that have also seen, you know, TV spots and billboards and direct mail pieces and, you know, 3 dozen emails and a bunch of retargeting display ads. Like, but there are ways that you can delight and entertain, reinforce your message on really any media channel that if you do it really well, you can capture a few extra seconds, another minute of a consumer's mind share, which is relationship building.
Yeah. And I think in like the direct mail world, I just think about like the mail I get personally. And then I'm also a marketer. So I think about these things when I get them in the mail. But like, you're right. It's like the pieces that are going to give you that extra value. I love the interactivity of the origami pooper scooper. I think that's brilliant. But something that makes you want to open it, consume it versus throwing it in the recycle bin, right? Like that's ultimately the goal. You want to make sure they're seeing it. But I think part of it goes hand in hand too with an earlier comment you made about obviously the brand has to have a great product and a great service so that the customer is open and excited to actually see something from you in your mailbox, right? And curious, but then it has to deliver on giving them that value. I had something I remember once from like, I do a lot of those different food delivery services. And I remember one of them had done like a great printout that was around like cooking conversions. And it was nicely sized. So like one cup equals blank, like how many of this is in half a gallon, you know, those kind of things. And for me, I was like, oh, that's actually really helpful because I often have to be like, okay, I'm doubling this or if I'm halving this recipe, what do I need to do? And just my other cooking. So I actually like taped that up on the inside of my cabinet in my kitchen. So, and it's branded, you know, with this company's name. So that was another great example for me. It was just like that value of they knew, like, obviously I'm cooking their food where everything's already portioned out, but I'm doing other cooking besides what they give me. So I appreciated that. And I like your yoga example too, because I could see people like putting that up in their workout room or snapping a picture of it and bringing it with them to the gym or, you know, if they're working out at the gym too.
Yeah. You know, when we were first starting to kind of explore the idea of building Postie, I was able to be a fly on the wall watching my wife engage with a piece of direct mail. And you brought up the food delivery category. It was another known brand in the space that was just starting to experiment with direct mail. I think they became a customer shortly thereafter. We received a piece of mail, and I think it was, you know, one of the kind of standard offers, X number of free, you know, meals or whatnot. And I think this was one of the pre-prepared meals, so not like the do-it-yourself kits. And my wife took that specific advertisement out of a pile of mail, and it sat on her kitchen table for easily a week, maybe longer. And then I noticed it was gone. I deliberately didn't say anything. I just wanted to watch the experience and learn something. And then I actually noticed that it had made its way onto a section of our kitchen island where, you know, kind of recipes and you know, pieces of paper that we're saving sit. And then it was like 2 weeks later. So we're talking about like all in 3 or 4 weeks after that piece of mail caught my wife's attention. I came home and I opened the freezer and there were like a dozen meals in the freezer. And I just thought, holy cow, right? It's in a digital ad. It's so ephemeral. You need so much frequency and repetition, but that single piece of direct mail probably got 1,000 impressions, right? Every morning, every evening, multiple times, like, And eventually, the consumer, in this case, my wife, you know, decided to take action on it. And that to me became, okay, now I get the power of direct mail compared to different ad channels. And the reason that's important is because, you know, direct mail has a different cost basis than a newsfeed ad or a programmatic display impression or retargeting ad. But it's not a one-to-one measure. It's not, you know, in direct mail, you're talking about the individuals that you're reaching, many of whom you might be, you know, you might be in front of for weeks on end. versus just how many ads you serve on a digital channel, because what, you know, that ad is served, you either click on it or it's gone. But with a channel like direct mail or out of home, there is a lasting effect. And for that reason, every channel can be profitable. You just have to go into it kind of understanding why it might be profitable and having some confidence and being able to leverage the channel for what it's good at doing.
Yeah. And I have a follow-up question then to that too, which is like for everyone listening who maybe isn't leaning into direct mail as much, or they used to and they've kind of switched gears and went digital and they're hearing this thinking, maybe we should do some more there. I mean, from a targeting perspective, you mentioned, you know, what you created is being able to really target through direct mail just with the capabilities that you do in the digital side. Could you give like a top line on like what are the targeting capabilities with direct mail? Like how deep can you go into like insights of who you're mailing to?
It's incredibly powerful. So the first thing to note is that direct mail is a channel that can be leveraged anywhere in the funnel. So, you know, we break it out into kind of three different groupings of campaign types to help the marketer kind of organize, you know, his or her thoughts. It's an incredibly scalable, effective customer acquisition or prospecting tool. So net new customers. It has just tried and true performance driver for CRM, whether that's customer retention, whether that's tightening up frequency or interval between purchases, increasing AOV, re-engaging lapsed customers. And now with modern technologies like Posty, there's the ability to run programmatic campaigns where you're actually integrating with your website for things like retargeting or funnel/cart abandonment campaigns. There are lead conversion or email capture conversion campaigns. There are programmatic lapsed customer capabilities. Like all that stuff is possible. So in the targeting world, when you think about audiences, you know, your first party data is liquid gold. And, you know, when you think about programmatic or CRM opportunities, not only can you leverage the behavioral data that that you're gaining insights for from how someone engages with your brand online or on a mobile app, website, et cetera, but the Posty platform, you could also tap into all sorts of machine learning kind of accelerants to help you drive performance by layering on really high quality, credible, compliant third-party data sets right on the Posty data management platform. So you can do things like build cluster analysis and gain insights into the unique segments within your CRM. And you can think about activating and speaking to them uniquely. On the prospecting front, just like you do on social platforms or programmatic platforms, you can build lookalikes from various CRM seed audiences. So you can look at recent purchasers or high average order value customers or, you know, max lifetime value customers. And you can then train lookalikes with a matter of clicks from the Posty data management platform that pulls in all of this amazing third-party quality data that's highly predictive to find customer or prospect segments that look most similar to, you know, these various consumer segments. And you're accelerating your ability to, to find audiences that perform within, you know, whatever the KPI that you're holding this channel accountable for. It really is just about anything that you can do on a social platform, on a programmatic platform, through email, or on a retargeting platform. That's all enabled, within direct mail. Historically, it either wasn't possible to unlock the programmatic capabilities because you do need those integrations and software, but there were ways to do CRM campaigns and prospecting campaigns. It's just that the math was less complex, the performance wasn't as consistent. Mm-hmm. It took longer times and bigger budgets, longer lead times to execute and learn. And we just look at that and quite frankly, you know that that the channel can do better. And that's what we focus on day in, day out.
Excellent. Thank you for that overview. That's really helpful. Well, we are at time, so we're going to be wrapping up. But before we close, I would like to just kind of one piece of advice you have for my listeners on how to better connect with their audiences. What would be like one thing you'd want to leave everyone with after listening to this episode?
I would say don't blur the lines between insights and the authenticity behind how you're developing your brand. But both of them have to be really powerful. And what I mean by that is you have to lean in deeply and leverage all of the kind of listening and insight gaining tools that are available now to really care about and unlock deep understanding around what your consumers look like, the different segments, why they're engaging with your product. But you don't want to over-rotate on the insights that you're gaining and change your business just to please a specific consumer or consumer segment at a specific time and place. If you you are a business, a product, a service, a brand that has a very, kind of mission-driven reason for existing, you do have to be, authentic and committed to those reasons. It has to be organic. And then you use the insights that you gain from your marketing, your merchandising, your data capture in order to, hold yourself accountable, making sure that the messaging that you're putting in the world is resonating and is presenting that authentic message. But you don't want to be chasing the right message just to get someone to convert at the expense of the authenticity and kind of long-term storytelling and brand that you're developing.
Excellent. All right. So before we close, I want to get all of your contact information so people who want to connect with you or posting know how to reach out to you. So how can people connect with you online?
Sure. So if you're interested in learning more about Posty, our team's amazing. We really do invest in hiring just really, really quality, smart folks. And you can find them and us at posty.com, posty.com. And there's an opportunity to request a demo or contact from one of our team members. There's also a ton of quality content that we're constantly publishing. Just if you're looking to learn, not ready to engage with us yet, case studies and best practices and capabilities. The easiest platform to reach me on is LinkedIn. David L. Fink is my handle. And we'll get you that in the show notes as well.
Yes.
LinkedIn Messenger is a really easy way to reach me.
Excellent. Okay. I will make sure to put those in the show notes, folks, which you will see on the link here in this podcast episode description and whatever player you're listening to right now. I also, as you were talking, Dave, I was thinking for my listeners, I had a earlier podcast episode that was also on an episode related to something in your inbox where I had David Wax on from Handwritten with a Y instead of an I for Handwritten. And he was talking about kind of reimagining like the handwritten note in the digital age and like how sending out like those digitally written thank you notes increases consumer responses 23 times. And so that paired with this conversation on how direct mail really is like something that brands should be thinking about and can be thinking about how it is evolving. And so that's what I love about what you're doing at Posty is really the new direct mail marketing and how you do it in the current age. It's really smart. So if anyone's interested in that handwritten notes episode to pair and combo with this, because I think they're nice and complementary topics, that was episode 37. So you can just scroll back and take a listen to that one. So huge thanks again, Dave, for being on the show. This was great.
Thanks for having me. Awesome conversation. I think it's always great when I'm engaging in a show that's hosted by an actual marketer. Just a different level of insights that I think we can share.
Yeah.
Thanks for hosting me.
Of course. All right, folks. Well, that wraps up today. Big thanks again to Dave Fink from Posty. Check out his posty.com. Connect with Dave on LinkedIn. And we'll see you here next week. Until next time, Kindred Speakers. If you're hearing my voice right now, you're likely a corporate content marketer of some kind looking to level up your brand storytelling career. What would it feel like to have the skills, confidence, and know-how to advance your brand storytelling results and love the work you're doing? In an ideal world, you and your content team are high-level strategic thinkers that know how to humanize your brand to drive 7x engagements and actions. You have the right creative mindset to attract your ideal audience and build brand trust and loyalty through storytelling. You're viewed as top performers in the company, and brand storytelling is valued because it's driving business results and supporting multiple channel teams. But things don't always go our way, right? Maybe your brand lacks a cohesive content strategy. Maybe you and your team are asked to deliver a lot for your company and it's hard to keep up. You know you need to invest in figuring out next steps in your company's brand storytelling plans, but haven't had the time to figure out how yet. And you need help integrating it across the organization. You personally want to level up your skills because you know you need to know how to do these things to advance in your career. You want your work to be valued so that you love coming to work each day, attracting leads, increasing repeat and referral actions, or creating a loved brand. And in this competitive market, you're looking for ways to stay competitive for yourself or retaining and attracting top talent for your company. That's why I created the Brand Storytelling Academy, a hands-on 3-month group training program designed to help corporate content marketers attract upper funnel leads that drive bottom funnel results through storytelling. For 1/6 of the cost to hire a person on the team or onboard a high-level brand storytelling strategist, you and up to 5 people on your team can be developing and accelerating your brand storytelling skills. Think of it like a college certification program for you and your team, but you get the knowledge a lot quicker, and your professor, me, has 20 years of hands-on experience guiding you along the way. Curious? Fill out the application at kindredspeak.com/apply to learn more, and I'll be in touch to answer all your questions and discuss if it's a good fit. Go to kindredspeak.com/apply.